it's the fourth Thursday of the month, and therefore it is Homepage Radio. I am Duo Dickinson. I just happen to be an architect and a writer, and I do this show, Homepage, every month here at WPKN, and every month the intrepid Rod Richardson is here. Hi, Rod.
Present.
Rod, like me, is soggy, and a little bit, you might notice, a little bit of static and burps in the signal today. There seems to be some gremlins left over from the Second World War inhabiting some of our system here, but I think you'll be able to muddle through, as will our guests. And today's show is timely, because today's show is about growing at home. Not hydroponics, not that illicit garden you've got in the attic or the basement, but your stuff all around your home. The fact that so many people want so badly to have things that live that are uncared for pets. They're not untended, but you don't have to feed them, maybe. They just might get smaller or die. But they're not like a parakeet or an animal. They are your garden. They are your tomatoes. They are your flowers. And whether you are experienced or curious, there are people who are devoted to growing things, making beauty with plants, the landscape, climate, and the culture that results. It becomes rich and rewarding when the expertise of the people involved gives options to every gardener. And this particular show, Growing at Home, has three extraordinary visionaries in the growing world, and they each have different insights and different perspectives on growing, and we'll be talking to them. But before we talk to them, I want to talk to you. I want to talk to you as somebody that often has dirt under my fingernails, often is cultivating and trying to make the most out of a glacial moraine site in coastal Connecticut over the last 32 years. Basically, we've created about 20 gardens where there's no sun, there's too much salt, there's a lot of rocks, and there's every impetus to grow very banal, dumb things, as opposed to thinking what will survive, what will inhabit. Also, what are some useful volunteers, useful invasives, useful weeds, as well as maybe introducing species that over time end up going crazy, like the creeping hydrangea that we have in two places in our house, that one, after almost 20 years, is finally blooming, and the other is going out of its mind, for, I think, because of the wet season. And in all of this, I would like to just quickly read for you an excerpt from Michael Pollan's A Gardener's Education, simply because I relate to it, and I think you might too. From Michael Pollan: in the same way that the picturesque designers were always careful to include some reminder of our mortality in their gardens, a ruin, sometimes even a dead tree, the act of leaving parts of the garden untended and calling attention to its margins seems to undermine any pretense to the perfect power or wisdom on the part of the gardener. The margins of our gardens can be tropes too, but figures of irony rather than transcendence. They're antidotes. In fact, antidotes to our hubris. It may be in the margins of our gardens that we could discover fresh ways to bring our aesthetics and our ethics about the land into some meaningful alignment. And I think in this cold, rainy spring that we've been having, where plants are growing slowly, if at all, or rotting, or very much in a mold condition, I think it is really imperative that gardeners all around us actually think about where they want to go with gardening, what they actually want to do with their gardens. Right now, what I'm doing is essentially, or I did this spring, was maintain. I cut back a huge amount of overgrowth that had happened over 2 or 3 years since we'd had a garden tour through our property. But I'm also mowing the lawn. And Poland also talks about mowing the lawn. And I'll give you a brief excerpt of that, because I think his perspective is pretty interesting. Mowing the lawn, I feel like I was battling the earth rather than working it. Each week, it sent forth a green army, and each week I beat it back with my infernal machine. Unlike every other plant in my garden, the grasses were anonymous, massified, deprived of any changes or development whatsoever, not to mention any semblance of self-determination. I ruled a totalitarian landscape. It occurred to me that time as we know it doesn't exist in the lawn. Since grass never dies or is allowed to flower and set seed, lawns are nature, purged of sex or death. No wonder Americans like them so much. In that attitude, in this world of growing at home, we're going to take a musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Lucy Van Loo, an incredible gardener who spans not only the distance between the landscape and the house and America and Britain, but also in terms of the activist and the plants she designs, the plantings she designs, but also the plants that she actually uses. And in so, it balances weather, sustainability, resilience, and the love of growing things, which can usually be quite daunting. And she's going to be one of the three experts that have fertilized literally thousands of scenarios for every budget, type of site, and even client idiosyncrasy. Hearing their perspectives and anecdotes really can take any planning obsession and add joy to it. So join us in a minute or two while we take a quick music break and get a hold of Lucy. Well, welcome back to Homepage, and today joining us right now is Lucy Van Loo of, I think, Madison, right, Lucy?
Absolutely. Hello, duo.
Lucy owns Lucy Van Loo Gardens, and she has, as you can already tell from her incredible accent, is from Britain, and she has actually said that gardening is Britain's vernacular art. And over the last 15 years, she's been marrying gardening aspirations with reality. And in fact, she said to me today that she often thinks that gardens start with the softening of the house, which to an architect who's had Lucy's work spread around my work is actually completely true. But she also is not only a resident of Madison, but her family came from Essex in the UK, where the lessons are well learned in how gardens develop and change over time. I would call you a plantaholic, Lucy. Would you call yourself a plantaholic?
No, duo, I don't call myself a plantaholic. but my husband and my daughter, too, as they roll their eyes when I expound on plants.
Why don't you take a minute or two and just tell me about your business. What do you do in any given day?
I have a single practice, you know, single design practice, and I work with clients now pretty locally to the shoreline around Madison, and I help them create gardens. I don't have a team of people myself. to implement it. I tend to work with various landscapers, but most importantly, the client. And I think the my first thing is to really listen to what they want, how they perceive their gardens, or yard, of course, as it's called here. How is it somewhere to, is it, it's a lot of people want particular activities to take place in it, if there are children, space to play. It very much depends on the individuals, particularly the husbands and wives' background, as how they see. And very often I come up with a classic the classic dilemma of the husband wants lots of lawn and nice, clean, open spaces, and the wife, I'm making gross generalizations, of course, wants much more of a pretty, often English-style borders and things. And so one very much has to marry the aspirations of both and bring in all the functions, but we're, of course, as you'll know as an architect, limited to what the site offers.
Yeah.
And I would say even more than architecture and house building, one has to work with what nature gives us. There are constraints, but as often you know, the constraints are what makes one be really creative in what one comes up with. One doesn't often start with a blank sheet of paper or a blank open space.
So one of the great limitations, I think, of New England is it's pretty extreme seasons. I mean, there are places that are warmer and there are places that are colder, but I'm not sure there are many places that are both as warm and as cold as New England. And I'd like your thoughts, because I would value your perspective. What are your thoughts about this strangely mild winter and this strangely wet spring? What is that doing to your thinking?
Oh, well, the strangely wet thing is delightful, because I've been in Madison for 15 years now. So we've been in the same house same garden for 15 years. So I've experienced plenty of that. But the biggest contrast from my background that I see is the extremes in winter. It's not only the heavy snowfall, the fact that the ground is frozen for so long, so everything really just stops. But by early in the new year, the colors are completely bleached out of it, which is enormous contrast to sort of the England, where however cold the winter gets, and it never gets as cold as here, the grass stays green, most of the shrubs stay green, so you still have this green outline, whereas I often come back from spending, say, Christmas in England, and I realize that everything is gray. And that's what is one of the biggest challenges for garden and landscape designers, is this grey bleachedness of the landscape.
I also find that, you know, working in New England, which is a glacial moraine in general, and comes out of a history of a 300-year little ice age, and tried desperately for 300 years to actually have beyond subsistence farming, where there are so many rocks and there's so much salt. I find that what percentages of your sites would you call to be as wonderfully encouraging as English sites?
Oh, I think I come from originally Essex, England, where there is not a rock to be had. So actually, I'm endlessly sending pictures of enormous great stones we dig out of our garden, or the stone walls, to my mother, who is green with envy. However, I do curse it when there's the pile of stones at the end of the garden every time you I do curse it sometimes. However, I love it, the fact that we've got this wonderful indigenous building material, and I very rarely stray away from those sort of materials when I'm designing and building gardens. It naturally fits in with our landscape, and so I don't tend to be terribly imaginative, and I tend to use what we have locally.
I would dispute the last statement about not being imaginative, but I do think there is an interesting thing which maybe you would revile at or simply not agree with, which is that in our site, our almost 2 acres of extremely tough, salt poisoned, very dim, very rocky landscape, we find that occasionally an invasive will come in, you know, and be phenomenally great, and we'll actually not take it out, and it will dominate a certain quarter for 10 or 20 years. I mean, right now we have an amazing sort of efflorescence of wild oats that goes along one border of my property, and it's growing so well and fast, I'm thinking that it's got to be illegal. I mean, it seems like a wonderful grass.
Oh, I agree. I've planted that on in a client's garden. It looks fabulous, but I suddenly found the next year and the years following that there were a lot of opportunistic
yes.
seedlings all over the site.
Over.
I have one of my favorite perennials, Eupatorium chocolate, which has this lovely purple foliage and gorgeous sort of cloud of white flowers in the autumn, but it does enjoy finding new places to grow. I don't mind it too much because it's easy to weed out and it's not too dominant, but yes, some of the things that are most popular, can be very opportunistic.
Well, we also, at one point, and this it probably was illegal when we planted, although we bought it from a legitimate purveyor, was ajuga. And every once in a while, ajuga will completely disappear from one part of my site and then appear on moss in other places.
And it's a very
weird temporal, I don't even know what you would call it. It's really not an edge. It's almost a ground cover.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I try to do more and more with native plants. However, I'm not purist. I'm pretty organic, but I'm also pragmatic. There are some things that, like poison ivy or Japanese knotweed, where the pragmatic approach is to use something like Roundup.
Right.
But on the whole, and I steer more and more towards using native varieties of things that won't actually then decide they're going to take over. But let's face it, you turn your back on a garden, particularly here where the conditions are so wonderful, you turn your back on anything and nature will take what wants to take over.
Now we have a few minutes left, and you left me a note that used a phrase that I'm hoping it can be told in less than 3 minutes, but you said, the story of Eddie Bernstein.
Oh, this my parents have been gardening, the same garden in Essex, England, for 63 years. And my father was in the removal business, and he had a very good friend and colleague who came from Philadelphia, Eddie Bernstein, who I think came from Eastern Europe here as a refugee, or his parents did. And they were having lunch in my parents' garden, which is gorgeous and lush. And, oh, this must have been 25 years ago. And they were talking about what they would do if they had spare money. And Mummy would say, oh, I would plant a tree or I'd plant a rose. And Eddie said, you are so fortunate to be able to have such confidence that you are going to be there to see it.
Oh my!
You know, when my family, you buy something portable that you can take with you, and it stuck with me, that little story, that gardens are a result of a certain amount of safety and security and permanence, and that. And particularly in this day and age, although I believe there is a very strong drive in so many people to grow things, to garden, it really, we are so very fortunate to have the stability and security as a society to be able to plant a tree or plant a rose and be confident that we are going to be there to enjoy it.
Well, one of my clients is a returning urban dweller. In fact, she moved from New York City to New Haven, and she has in front of her the perfect perfect flat lawn, and her desire is to have no lawn. Her desire is to have no lawn but no more Pachycandra. The idea would be to do something that would be beautiful, would not need a ton of weeding, and certainly not need fertilizing or even watering.
Yeah,
if that was you thinking about an urban environment like New Haven or a tight suburban environment, what would be the things that you would actually apply to that little space?
If it was a little space, I would really want to know how the client wants to use that outside space.
Mm.
I mean, there is something very, I'm going to play devil's advocate, there is something very restful to the eye about a small amount of grass.
Mm.
But I would I would use gravel. I would use other sorts of greenery. But it very much depends on how the space is going to be used, and some of the pragmatic ways it can be managed. You know, ideally, one would love to say, okay, chamomile or moss. But I've seen
she said moss. In fact, and I said, well, is it true? And I'm going to question you about this. I have actually heard and even tried one time the idea that you can harvest moss from somewhere, powderize it, or mix it up with milk, and then throw the milk on the ground, and then it spawns.
Oh yes, if you've got the sort of if you live in Maine and it's damp and it's mild and you've got the sort of but in our sort of climate where you might get periods of drought, well, the moss will all die or go dormant or something, and so it won't look. It's all about location. Location. We have to work with nature,
right.
And one has to kind of roll with the flow, if you know what I mean, go with the flow.
Yeah. If you had to, in the last minute that we have with you, if you had to sort of put your really deep bi-coastal knowledge base to work, what would be the one truly distinctive bias or mindset or approach that distinguishes the English garden from the American garden?
Oh my goodness. What's the distinctive? I don't think there's not one thing, because you can't say there's an American garden.
Ah.
Gardens are so local. What we have on the East Coast is so different from California or the Southwest. I think I can't say that there's one thing.
Well, that's actually saying something.
Is that, it? Okay,
yeah, absolutely. It actually it's very empowering to me.
Yeah, right. Oh, no. There's nothing. You know, in England, we are incredibly fortunate. Despite being on the same latitude as Winnipeg, we have a benign climate, which means that so much grows. We can be in the garden all the year round, whereas even I, by the end of July, want to go to the beach rather than sit in the garden.
Lucy, this has been wonderful. This is Lucy Van Loo, who's a garden designer out of Madison, Connecticut. And we appreciate your time. And next, we're going to be talking to Ann Christie, who is a landscape designer who does all different things with all different sites, not only houses but other things, but has an interesting perspective, a different one than almost any woman or person or anything that I've met in terms of the landscape, one where, just like Lucy, she listens to the landscape and evolves the design. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with Ann Christie. Like that music. Well, we're back at Homepage Radio here at WPKN, a bastion of free talk, free music, and actually the wonderful freedom of expression, which needs your support every day. And as you can hear, there's a little bit of static in the background in my headphones, so there might be on your speakers. Realize that it's being worked on, and hopefully you can hear the great discussion through that static. And with us this moment is a great landscape designer, 30-year career, Ann Christie. And she was educated at Temple University. And what she wrote me was hilarious. And Ann, I really appreciated this. She had a grandmother who was a landscape architect and a father who was an architect. And so she grew up with this incredible deep appreciation and, of course, love of the humans, but love of the legacy of the humans in her lineage. And tell me a little bit about how your genome has given you courage over the last 30 years as a growing person?
Hi, Duo.
Hi, Anne.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
So I had this wonderful upbringing, having a grandmother as a landscape architect.
Wow.
She was one of the first women landscape architects in the country. She went to Lothrop School for Women in Rhode Island, which had one of the first programs for women in landscape architecture, and that school is now RISD.
Wow, I did not know that.
Indeed. And so I used to go around to her job sites as a little girl, and she would take me and explain to me what she was doing and show me what we... And she worked on some magnificent estates where people still had full-time gardeners, just a really rarefied experience. And then I had the good fortune of her son, my father, being an architect.
Mm.
And so got a great appreciation. He would take me around and show me all the buildings he had designed. And so I really had a great appreciation for how each was independently magnificent, but how they marry so beautifully as well.
Well, I've been graced by the fact that any number of occasions, your work has really enhanced my work as an architect. So I think there's a wonderful common vision that everyone can understand between both the outside of the house, the house itself, and the inside of the house, and a lot of the false distinctions between whether you're a designer, a decorator, a home designer, or an architect with a capital A. That all just goes away once you see the beauty that you personally create. And I think what I think I would love to hear you talk about are the opportunities and extreme difficulties of the Connecticut, especially, but just New England environment that you counter every day and how you deal with those difficulties.
Well, Lucy actually covered a lot of those things. I mean, yes, I work with the client. I work with the site. I work with the house, with an architect, if there's one involved. And you really try to meld all the features together, including what was there before, what is there now.
Mm.
It's just there are lots of opportunities.
I think of you also as somebody that feels fairly empowered to work with trees as well as gardens and also large, for lack of a better word, hedgy things or planting things. Do you find that the larger the site, the larger the elements you're bringing to bear?
Sure. And I think that the larger the site, the more structure is needed. And that structure can take the form of trees or can take the form of hardscaping. But you really want something that's going to be cohesive and pull things together.
Yeah.
So, every site has its particular little quirky peculiarities.
tell us if there was one peculiarity which had either an aha moment or an obvious solution, but a peculiarity that sits in your mind in this 30 years of practicing design.
Oh, in this 30 years of... So last year I did a project in Milford, required some very sensitive site design with some rain gardens to... Oh. Take the water off the site. And, very sensitive, very thoughtful, evolved over a long period of time, worked with an architect on the project. And the project this spring was, everything was coming out, leafing out, everything was working beautifully. It just, really came through the winter wonderfully. And then about 3 weeks ago, a tree came up through this new driveway.
No kidding.
In the middle of the driveway, you know, all the plantings are beautiful. Jeepers. And it's like, what do you do with this?
Good Lord. How big was this invader?
Well, it started as kind of a little volcano in the driveway.
Oh, my goodness.
If you can picture such a thing.
Oh, my God.
And so it's going to require, exposing it, applying an herbicide to it.
Oh, there you go.
Digging it out, and then finding some kind of creative way to patch this area.
Yeah.
So creating something that will be aesthetically pleasing will look like it was always planned to be there. So sometimes the unexpected really can drive some very creative solutions.
So when you have had a formal education in landscape architecture at Temple, right? Is that,
yes.
That was your thing? For people that don't know, because most people don't know, tell us what that education was like, how many years, what sort of courses did you take, and how you find that education helps or maybe even hinders you today.
Well, I had a great education at Temple University. It really focused on plants. I found that when I came out, I had a really great knowledge of plants that a lot of my peers did not have. So that was really great. It also had a really great nuts and bolts kind of approach. So we would learn how to price projects. We would go to nurseries on field trips to see how plants were grown. You know, really a good nuts and bolts kind of education, and that's, you know, I've always been very grateful to Temple.
Did you go and apprentice with a landscape firm when you left college, or did you always go into your own independent practice?
I actually started with a landscape firm in Philadelphia, and it did very large scale projects, mostly commercial projects.
Mm.
I decided to move up to Connecticut, wanting to get out of the city. I also had some friends up here that I wanted to be closer to.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh wow, I didn't know that.
Yep.
And did the what I call the sort of wonderful weirdness of New England, its extremities, was that something that was just independent of your pre-existing friendships, was that something that drew you to Connecticut? Was the almost volatile nature of the way the seasons change?
Well, I had been to New England before. I actually lived, before I went to Philadelphia to school, I'd lived a little bit in Vermont. And really love New England. I love the hilliness of it without it being stark mountains. I love the verdant hills. And was really drawn to the farms, the stone walls, you know, everything about it. There's a romanticism to the landscape in New England that's hard to beat.
One of the hallmarks of your work, it's something that I find extraordinary, is the, I would call it two things, resilience, but also sustainability. In other words, it's easy to make a garden look good in the first year or a landscape look good in the first year, but you take real note of how much salt is in the spray and how much sun there is to take advantage of, what the soil conditions are. That has to have been a direct result of many, many planting experiences all throughout New England and probably some interesting failures as well.
Oh, for sure. You know, growing up in Cincinnati, there is not salt water.
No.
So that was not something to contend with. There also wasn't the amount of wind.
Really?
You know, it's not in Tornado Alley or anything.
Right.
So, you know, coming here and being on the shoreline, yes, you've got the salt spray, but you've also got this incredible wind to deal with. And so there's been a learning curve for sure over the course of my 30-something years here. And it's challenging. But on the other hand, the shoreline affords some really great opportunities that are not negatives. Obviously, it's got a more moderating climate than inland. Yeah. It has beautifully well-drained soil and has little microclimates. So if you're not in the direct wind of Long Island Sound, and it's at times furies, you know, you can find little niches in protected areas that will give you the opportunity to use plants that are marginally hardy here.
Right.
I have a client in Branford that is on the water, and there's a little protected area protected by a house and a fence, and there are three beautiful Natchez crepe myrtles
Wow.
that are trees that are flourishing there.
Wow.
And I would not ever, ever, ever use that plant anywhere but a little microclimate like that.
You know, so
that's a wonderful thing that the shoreline provides.
It's so much of what design is about, and I think people listening to the radio should appreciate this, is the give and take and the lack of control that any designer has over all the criteria that are essentially imposed on them. And I can say with my own personal experience that you take those controls, those uncontrollable things, and really make some extraordinary beauty, and I really appreciate your work, Anne.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, more inland sites and working with the natural ledge on a site.
Yeah.
You know, it also offers such beauty that you just, it's extraordinary to have the lichens and the mosses growing on natural ledge or on natural rock inland. And again, that's not the kind of thing that you find in other landscapes.
Well, it's extraordinary you've spent this time with us. I really want to thank you for your time. Thank you, Anne Christie.
Oh, thank you, Duo.
And now we are going to go, after a short break, to an extraordinary human being, Nancy De Brule Clemente, who has a similar mission, a mission of fostering growth and fostering control and adapting to a lack of control in the landscape. Nancy is, and I'm sure many people listening know very well of this, Nancy is the creator of NatureWorks in Northford, Connecticut. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Nancy. Welcome back to Homepage on WPKN in Bridgeport. My name is Duo Dickinson. I'm an architect. And this show is called Growing at Home. And it's about the various ways that this interesting environment that we are in both excites and exhilarates us, but also often depresses us, especially when you think about the unending chilly rain that we've been having for several weeks. But joining with me right now is Nancy De Brule Clemente, who is the founder since 1983, Nancy, of NatureWorks Horticultural Services in Northford, Connecticut. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on. This is wonderful. I've been listening to the other guests and listening to all the different conversations. It's so interesting.
Well, and you were educated at UConn at the Radcliffe Hicks School. Tell me a little bit about the Radcliffe Hicks School.
Well, it's a 2-year school. It's not a full 4-year program. I had gone to UConn for teaching and dropped out and wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but lived up there and met all these people in the horticulture and agriculture school. This was back in the 70s, and I liked what they were doing, and it made sense to me, even though I had never had a garden in my life. And I told my parents I was going back to school for horticulture, and they're like, what? So it was a very practical program, 2 years of really practical stuff. You know, really just got done with it. They wanted me to go on to the other, you know, finish it and get a bachelor's. And I was like, no, I need to work.
Wow.
And I just jumped out into the field and started working at a nursery in Hamden. And then a few years later, I started my own business. And it's been 34 years of constantly learning.
Well, and you got a degree in floriculture, which
floriculture.
To the untrained brain that I am, says to me more the flowering side of things. Is that correct?
Yeah. When I first studied it, I was designing flower gardens, and I was learning to be a florist. And my first job was in a garden center that had a florist shop. My minor was kind of like nursery stock. But in my heart, I wanted to be a farmer. But it just wasn't the way to make a living back then.
Right.
And so I went into what was the most, you know, easy job to get, which was at a garden center in a landscaping company. And that's what I specialized in. I still grow a ton. I now grow a lot of food, and food is, you know, well, food's always necessary, but food is back.
So when you say grow a lot of food, you have your own personal residence where you've got a large scale. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I used to live in Guilford on the water, on a rocky hill, in the shade.
Right.
It was not conducive to growing food. I had one tomato plant and I moved it around the deck. You probably understand this.
Too well.
I don't know where you live, but it sounds like the same thing. So when, about 13 years ago, I moved to Middletown in the center of the state, which in an old farming area, but it was a neighborhood now, and I have almost 2 acres. And on that, I have 15 raised beds that are 12
wow.
to 3 feet. Just in my spare time, I grow food. And I mean, lots of containers and pots, and I grow a lot of vegetables and peaches and raspberries and tons of blueberries and asparagus and lots of herbs. And I do a lot of edible landscaping for myself. And I also use it as a ground for teaching. I love to teach.
So you bring people out to the site. You actually bring people there?
No, I keep my home private. I do it through writing. I write a weekly email. I do lectures, and I do a lot of social media, Facebook.
Right.
We do Facebook Live, and you know, we post pictures, and so and I teach that way.
What's your Facebook?
I do a lot of classes about it.
Is your Facebook site just called Nature Works?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So anybody can go and take a look at that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we're now doing Facebook Live, which my sister, who works at MIT, told me I should try this. And I'm like, okay, whatever that is. You know, I started in the 80s. I mean, I didn't even have a fax machine. So this is all, you know, I mean, this is all, you know, this media thing is just growing.
Well, and I can
now once a week we do it. It's funny.
I can tell you that if for the people that are listening out there, if you've never been to NatureWorks in Northford, which is another fancy word for North Branford, off of Route 22, right? So basically up there, what is very, very strange and wonderful about your property is you think about garden centers, and you think about very, very large, very commercial, spreading environments, and you go up, and it's essentially a little tiny building on a 1-acre site with about with about 3 or 4 microclimates that you either have or created there. Tell us how you set on that site, and tell us a little bit of the history and development of NatureWorks.
Well, I started my business in Stony Creek on the corner of 146 and Thimble Islands Road in an old gas station.
That's right.
And that was in 1983.
Yes.
I hung up my shingle 5 days a week. I gardened for people. And on the weekends, I had this little retail store. And next to it, it was taken for granted. And that's still there. And they would sell my plants during the week. And then on the weekends, I'd come in and sell plants. And then the next year, I got a manager or an employee, let's say,
right.
And she worked and sold plants during the week, and I continued to garden. And in 1990, the woman that owns Take It For Granted bought the building, and I had to move, and I had couldn't afford the shoreline at that point.
Right.
I mean, there was just nothing. I went up and down with Walmart. There's just no way. I never owned anything. I didn't have any money. So I was driving to my parents' house in West Hartford, and I kept going by this cute little house on this cute little patch of land. I'm like, well, maybe I can afford that. So I went to the zoning board, and I went for an application, and I changed it from a home to a little business, and I had to get all these variances, and I built it here, which was kind of insane because it seems huge to me because I was on a gas station corner.
Right.
But now it's an acre, so it's including everything, so it's tiny.
Well, I think
it's ridiculous, but we do it.
Actually, the tininess is a really good transition to why I think you are at least unique to this microclimate, to this part of the world, in that it's not just that you're a purveyor or a designer. You are also what I would call an advocate. You also have a POV about organic farming or organic planting and naturalizing. Could you distill for me and the people listening, what makes you different from a typical garden advocate? Why would you think NatureWorks offers a different perspective than most garden centers?
Well, when I started, I had been working in a greenhouse. I had to get a pesticide license. I had to spray a lot of really bad toxins that are now illegal. Mm. And so I started my business, and I said, I am not going to do that. I'm going to be organic. And there was really nothing to teach you to do this except for Organic Gardening Magazine. But I am a very determined person, and I'm like, I'm just going to do this. So at first, I was considered kind of insane and nuts and crazy. But I did it anyway. And it was not easy because there was no protocol for this anywhere. But I joined the Northeast Organic Farming Association, which is called NOFA, and went to a summer conference and then was asked to be on the board. And I met like-minded people throughout New England that were doing this, both farmers and landscapers. And I started organizing the landscapers I knew into groups where we would teach each other. And then I was asked to become the president of NOFA. And I'm like, I don't even have a farm.
And what is NOFA?
NOFA is the Organic Farming Organization. And they said, well, you can be the president because you can run a meeting. And I'm like, I don't have a farm. I just grow, a landscape, and I have a garden. So I'm like, doesn't matter. So I became the president of the organic farming group in the state.
Right.
And that was really exciting. And it was a time of great change. And I helped the group form a second branch where we started training organic landscapers, and now we have a certification program for organic landscapers.
NOFA does.
It's called the organic. It's called the Land Care Organic Land Care Practitioners, and
wow.
They train for a 4-day course. That's a very intensive course. They get certified. They have to, they have to take a really hard test. I'm one of the teachers. There's a whole set of standards. There's a website up for the organic land care that you can look up somebody if they are, in fact, certified organic, which is light years away
right.
from what it was like for me back in the early 80s.
Well, let me ask you one interesting question because in a certain time you have older children. I have older children who have many friends. And also just being an older person in New England, two things that I would love your take on because I think you have a unique perspective. One is the whole concept of artisanal food production at a higher cost, but with using extremely organic elements, but also endemic and natural to the region elements. But then secondly, maybe it's part of this, is the whole woofing world of students, of recent graduates or young people that go and essentially apply the land in a organized sort of or disorganized way, woofing and artisanal gardening, where does that fit into your background?
Well, it wasn't like this at the beginning. There were farmers, and there were organic farmers, and they were pretty straight organic farmers. They grew food and sold it. There's been a huge shift in the last 10 years where organic farmers have become very savvy. I think it's because of the internet, but they've become very savvy, and they do a lot of value-added products, I guess we would call it, and they're so surely growing things that you would not have seen at farmers markets before. There's a farmer I know who produces turmeric and ginger and pawpaw. I mean, you know, there's things that, and, you know, people are putting out aronia bushes for the black aronia berries, which are a superfood. We're seeing stuff that you haven't, that nobody ever saw before. And so that's permeating the industry, because if you're just going to grow an acre of zucchini, you're going to have to really work hard to make money on that. But if you can grow an acre of specialty crops and know how to market them, you can make a fine living. So that's the first thing. But also, the young people that I'm seeing, I'm on a scholarship committee for the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Foundation, and we give out scholarships to horticulture students, and every student applying, almost every single student is looking for sustainability,
right,
organic, environmental, blah, 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 and they all want to blend food and ornamental together. They just see it as one seamless, you know, undivided thing. Planting is planting, whether it's edible or not.
Isn't that Nancy? Because I've gone to your store for at least 25 years. Isn't that part of who you are? You see the aesthetic of all the things that grow. Am I wrong?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to me, you should have herbs in with flowers and food in with plant. You know, it is seamless. But it wasn't seamless in this industry until recently. And now, in my industry, food is huge. It's a huge part of what I do in the spring, whereas before it was something I did because I wanted people to grow food. But now people are like, you know, it's veggie time, rain or no rain. People are lunatics. Like, if you don't get your Jimmy Nardello pepper or your whatever tomato, they go out of their mind. It's wonderful. Wonderful to see it. People are growing food everywhere. It's just great. And herbs, too. Herbs have become really popular. People are getting much more grounded. And my hope is that someday our children's children will turn around and say, what were you thinking, like poisoning the earth and then putting food in it and growing it and then eating it? Like, what made you think that was a good idea? I mean, because that's what I'm seeing in the young people these days. That they're already there. They're 100% there. You don't have to convince them of anything, you know.
Well, it's been wonderful to have you. It's been wonderful to have you. I think your perspective originally on flowers, then on planting, and now on food is a wonderful arc of I would say, commitment and advocacy, which we all can learn from. Thank you, Nancy, for being on the show today.
It's totally my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much. And this is Homepage on WPKN. WPKN is a very interesting place because it's responsive. It ends up often riffing on technologies. You can hear the maybe a little bit of the static in the background that's being worked on now, but also on the fact that there are many ways of thinking about music, and one of those ways is jazz. And the general manager here, Steve, basically asked me to put in a little plug for something he's been promoting that I've been deeply involved with, which is jazz at Trinity Church in the Green in New Haven tomorrow, which is going to be Friday. And in that advocacy of seeing the beauty in music, just like today, we've really invested a huge amount of time of seeing the beauty in gardens and growing things, are going to be the Brubeck Brothers, which are two brothers and two musicians from the West Coast, are going to come to Trinity Church at 7:30 tomorrow night, and they will play some extraordinary music along with Neighbor Music School's premier jazz ensemble, and also the actual kids' choirs of Trinity Church in the Green. And we have free tickets from WPKN at 203-331-9756, 203-331-9756. This is the Brubeck Brothers at Trinity Church in the Green in New Haven. We would love it if you would call and get those free tickets and support WPKN. And this is Duo Dickinson, architect for Homepage Radio in the blissful bosom of WPKN Radio.
Support for WPKN comes from Grillo Services of Milford, Connecticut, supplying organic topsoil, organic compost, mulch, dumpsters, decorative gravel, and more to Connecticut's residential, commercial, and municipal customers. Detailed information on all their organic garden and landscape services at grilloservices.com or 203-877-5070.
Hi, this is Cheryl A. Palmer, host of Speaking to Your Spirit, right here on WPKN 89.5 FM. Please join me on Saturday, May 27th, from 7 until 8 p.m., and listen to the live broadcast from some of the cast members of War Stories. War Stories, a real-life, engaging, and interactive stage production that has been performed at the Bushnell Theater in Hartford, Connecticut, and the Regina Quick Art Center at Fairford University. War Stories, real-life testimonies from men and women who will share their personal struggles in dealing with substance abuse, incarceration, and homelessness, and how they overcame negative experiences, traumas, and setbacks. War Stories, conceived and directed by Peter Van Heerden in collaboration with Sonia Huber and Nita Bentley, featuring veterans from the Homes for the Brave. War Stories. You don't want to miss it right here on WPKN 89.5 FM on Saturday, May 27th from 7 until 8 p.m.
Hi, I'm Ann. I'm a longtime listener of WPKN. I wanted to let you know that donating a vehicle is a really simple process. All you have to do is go to WPKN.org. You fill in a small bit of information, then submit it. For me, it took about 5 minutes to get a call back, then one follow-up call to set everything up. They were out the next day with a tow truck and took care of it all from there. If you're considering donating a car to help PKN, go for it. By donating, you avoid all the hassles of selling the vehicle yourself. Forget about the low offers, mechanical repairs, and liability issues. And not posting your phone number is also a big plus. My payment comes in the form of a tax deduction. But more than that, I get the great feeling of helping out my favorite radio station. WPKN needs our support, so it can remain the independent, freeform radio station that is such a rare find today.
On May 25th, 2017, IRIS, the Integrated Refugee and Immigration Services of New Haven, and the Branford Action Coalition will host an open dialogue on the refugee experience, from selection to resettlement. The program will be held from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Branford Fire Department, 45 North Main Street, Branford. This community forum will focus on the refugee experience and its impact on Branford and the shoreline, as well as the federal screening process, which ensures that refugees are properly vetted. Chris George, Executive Director of IRIS, will lead the program and will be joined by Betsy Hyde of the Refugee Welcome Committee. The forum will be moderated by Reverend Skip Ferry, pastor of the Short Beach Union Church. After the prepared presentation, there will be an open question and answer period and possibly an opportunity to talk with a local refugee family about their resettlement in Branford. Once again, that's May 25th at 7 p.m. at the Branford Fire Department, 45 North Main Street in Branford.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Mercy Learning Center. Mercy Learning Center is a 28-year-old literacy and life skills center for women located on Park Ave in Bridgeport. Our mission is to provide basic literacy and life skills training to low-income women using a holistic approach within a compassionate and supportive environment. Over the course of Mercy Learning Center's history, we've helped over 10,000 women in and around Bridgeport to learn English, advance their education, or earn high school diplomas. Volunteers are at the heart of Mercy's mission. Hundreds of adults of all backgrounds and areas of expertise volunteer as tutors to work with women twice each week for a total of 4 hours, teaching literacy and a range of other subjects. If you are interested in learning more about this highly rewarding volunteer opportunity or any of the other volunteer opportunities available at Mercy,